Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we have a great show. First up is Paul Piff. You may not know the name, but you've probably heard of some of his research. Paul's a social psychologist at UC Berkeley, and he studies behaviors associated with the wealthy. They're not more virtuous than the rest of us. Quite the opposite, in fact. Then we have a double segment interview with former banking regulator William K. Black. The occasion is the fifth anniversary of Lehman Brothers going into bankruptcy on September 15th, 2008. It's a great interview. But first, a few items you may have missed this week. First, a story that's just too rich. Senator David Vitter of Louisiana has been making life hell this week. He spent the whole week on the floor of the Senate blocking Senate business until he gets a vote on a bill that would repeal federal contributions to lawmakers' health care. Okay, so Democrats this week are firing back. They offered a counterproposal that would only cut off funding for lawmakers if there is, quote, probable cause to believe they solicited prostitutes. Vitter, of course, was implicated in the D.C. Madam prostitution scandal. In Politico, Emily Schultheis pointed out that in Germany, the parties typically put out a single 90-second ad pitching themselves to the voters. In other democracies, they have strictly limited campaign seasons. They'll campaign for a few weeks and then have a vote. It's a lot more pleasant for the voters, for the public, than our 18 months of ad wars and debates and punditry. But then again, we need to give our rich people the opportunity to spend hundreds of billions of dollars trying to influence us, or it wouldn't be really fair, would it? Vladimir Putin certainly made waves with his New York Times op-ed this week. Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey said it sickened him. It made him want to retch. He became ill. John McCain thinks turnabout is fair play and is placing an op-ed in Pravda criticizing Putin. Representative Steve Israel from New York is trying to do the same, but it's not clear that any Russian publications have heard of him or care what he has to say. Most people I run with despise Putin, of course, but are quite pleased with the prospect of a diplomatic solution to our standoff with Syria over chemical weapons. We're cool with him owning that mess. We'd be thrilled to see the UN secure Assad's chemical weapons stocks. It's a great exit hatch for this whole nightmare. But conspiracy nut Alex Jones sees through all of that stuff. What's really happening is that they're establishing a precedent where the UN can come in to, and I quote, he can come into any country they want that has any type of weapon systems and call them WMDs and then dismantle that country's infrastructure, says Jones. Then, and again I quote, everyone is going to be put back in the Stone Age to be controlled, and then Obama and the globalists and the robber barons, they're going to fly around in their jet copters and their Air Force Ones, you know, because there's multiple Air Force Ones, and their red carpets like gods above us, and they're going to get the life extension technologies. Folks, who let the cat out of the bag? Eventually, says Jones, virtually everyone will be extinct except for these globalists with their life extension technologies. Folks, Alex Jones is very, very popular. He also makes a fortune off of this stuff, off of the rubes. This week, a massive spill killed off all the fish in Honolulu Harbor. It wasn't oil. It wasn't an oil spill. It was molasses. According to the local NBC affiliate, 233,000 gallons of the stuff spilled when a pipeline ruptured. The shipping company, Matson Navigation, said that there's nothing it can do to clean up the mess. Molasses, apparently, is harder to clean up than oil. The state health department said it's the worst environmental disaster in Hawaii's history. And this story reminded me of the Boston molasses disaster. Have you ever heard of this? It happened in 1919 when a huge storage tank full of molasses ruptured in Boston, and a huge wave of the stuff rolled through the streets. Some say it was moving at 35 miles per hour, and it killed 21 people. They drowned in molasses and injured 150 more. The tank had been poorly constructed, and it wasn't sufficiently tested. But the company blamed anarchists, who were the Al-Qaeda of the day. They said anarchists had blown up the tank. And that narrative worked well for a guy named J. Edgar Hoover, who was then working with the Justice Department's Alien Enemy Division. See, the anarchists drew heavily from Eastern European and Russian and Italian immigrant communities. And about 8 months later, Hoover was put in charge of the Bureau of Investigation's Radical Division. And 4 years after that, he became head of the BOI, which would later be renamed the FBI. And the rest, as they say, is history. I leave you with a couple of gun stories. Steve Bracknell is the police chief in George Zimmerman's hometown. In a series of emails obtained by Think Progress this week, Bracknell agreed with a correspondent that George Zimmerman is, quote, a ticking time bomb and another Sandy Hook waiting to happen. So there's that. There are two new studies about gun violence. Researchers at Harvard University School of Public Health found that owning a firearm is a greater predictor for death by suicide than is suicidal behavior. And researchers at Boston University conducted the largest study of firearm ownership ever. They found that a 1% increase in the number of guns in a given state correlated with a 0.9% increase in gun homicides. But video games, twerking, rap music, anything but guns, right? Anyway, we'll take a quick break and then come right back with Paul Piff. Stay tuned. Back to the show. My next guest is someone whose research I've cited quite a bit over the past few years. Paul Piff is a social psychologist at UC Berkeley, and he's done a lot of research into the mindset of wealthy people. Paul, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on, Josh. It's really a pleasure.
So, for me, the context for your work actually comes from political scientists. Thomas Hayes is a scholar at Trinity University, and he recently published a study in the Political Science Quarterly, and he found that United States senators respond almost exclusively to the interests of their wealthiest constituents. He looked at 8 years of voting patterns, and he found that in some years they also were somewhat responsive to the middle class, in other years they weren't, and they were never responsive to the interests of the working poor. And this study confirmed what previous studies had found. Larry Bartell at Princeton came to the same conclusion in a 2005 study. So Paul, that brings us to your research about who these wealthy constituents are that wield so much influence over our political system. Again, this is from my perspective, this is the key context. Now, you're an academic, but I'm not, so I can say in very plain language that what you found seems to be that they tend to be jerks. Not all of them, of course, but they're more likely than the average Joe to be jerks. So let's just dig into this a bit. First, tell us about empathy, about sensitivity to the suffering of others.
So empathy is a broad psychological construct that refers to how able a person is mentally, psychologically, behaviorally, physiologically to relate to the mental states of others. And it's played a big role in our evolutionary history. It's played a big role to the emergence and evolution of human social groups. And it's really, really central to our survival. It's central to how a mother relates to the plight of her child, how siblings relate to one another. And it also, you know, it's a big variable that explains why people reach out across the oceans to save a leatherback turtle or dying individuals in an impoverished nation. So Empathy is a really central thing. It's something we all do. And one of the things that I've gotten really interested in is studying how empathy and compassion and all of its behavioral components vary by a person's levels of wealth and status in society. And I wouldn't say that we've been finding that wealthy people are jerks or more jerk-like necessarily. Wealthy people do a lot of really great things for society, but one of the things that we've been documenting is that the higher up in the social ladder you are, the less able you are to relate to the plight of others lower than you in the socioeconomic hierarchy. And from that emerges a lot of, I think, somewhat pernicious, if you will, or social costly outcomes. Like reduced compassion, reduced generosity, reduced helping behavior. And we've been documenting these patterns across a whole slew of laboratory studies that we've been running over the last 7 years.
And I should just make it clear that when I said wealthy, you do use a kind of a broader measure of social status that includes the job status and et cetera, et cetera. Now, I think it was your most recent study that found the wealthy tend to be more likely to be to exhibit narcissistic traits. Can you unpack that a bit for us?
Yeah, so the question there was whether people who are wealthy, and sometimes we measure wealth using how educated, prestigious someone's job is and how wealthy they are, this sort of broad construct. And sometimes I just look at a person's levels of wealth, how much money they have, how much money they make. So it kind of depends on the project. And in this latest one, I measure wealth in a whole bunch of different ways and status in a whole bunch of different ways and generally find that wealthier, higher status individuals are more likely, I think somewhat surprisingly, to feel that they're more deserving of good things in life. Now, that may not be totally surprising, but there's a lot of rational economics that would say that it's actually the less privileged in society who don't have, who should feel that they're more deserving of things because they're the ones that don't have them in the first place.
Right.
We find the opposite. And it's that entitlement, that feeling that I deserve more than others among the wealthier that actually explains why they're more narcissistic. And we measure narcissism in a whole bunch of different ways. But narcissism just refers to the extent to which a person thinks that they're more important, more omnipotent, figure larger in the world than other people around them.
And you also found that they're more likely to check themselves out in a mirror. Paul, any sense of the causal relationship here? Could it be that these traits are more likely to result in you having higher socioeconomic status rather than the kind of more intuitive explanation that wealth makes you more likely to feature these behaviors?
That's right. I'm a social scientist, and I'm really interested in the direction of these effects. What is it that's causing what? And, you know, for some people, it may not even matter. It may just matter that those who are the wealthier in society are more likely to exhibit certain traits than others. And that holds true independent of what variable is causing what. But because I'm a social scientist, I'm really interested in causality, as you, Josh, pointed to. And we've run a lot of different studies where we actually, while we can't manipulate people's actual wealth, I don't have billions of dollars to randomly assign people to different groups and then watch them 30 years later, we can and have devised certain psychological manipulations that can temporarily alter how much, for instance, you, Josh, think you have relative to other people. We've had people play these rigged games of Monopoly where they're the rich player or the poor player, and we've also devised a whole bunch of other kinds of really subtle manipulations where we temporarily make rich people feel poor or poor people feel rich. And the most, I think one of the really amazing lessons that we've learned is that even if you bring someone who's actually rich into the lab and temporarily make them feel poor, or bring someone who's poor and temporarily make them feel rich, you find the same patterns of behavior, which suggests that this isn't a characteristic of the wealthy at all. It's not as if wealthier individuals have these traits that necessarily make them behave these ways, but rather that the psychological experience of having more than others, and in many cases having so much more than others, that we see in society today, that really seems to be driving the psychological tendencies and patterns of behavior that we've been documenting.
That is absolutely fascinating. Folks, if you're tuning in, I'm speaking with UC Berkeley social psychologist Paul Piff. Paul, I lived in Germany for a while, and everyone there kind of agreed, it's almost like a running joke, that people who drive big, fancy cars tend to be more aggressive drivers. They're jerks. They drive like jerks. You actually have some scientific evidence to back up this kind of conventional wisdom. Can you tell us briefly about the crosswalk and intersection studies you conducted?
Yeah, so we ran those studies to sort of piggyback on a bunch of different laboratory studies that we'd done where we were looking at the relationship between a person's socioeconomic status, their levels of wealth, and how likely they were to break certain kinds of rules, something social psychologists refer to as unethical behavior or
right.
Unethical decision-making. And so we wanted to run some real-world extensions of this, and what we came up with was looking at the kind of car a person drives, because believe it or not, while there are exceptions, the kind of car you drive is hugely predictive of how much money you have. The correlation is very, very, very high. And so we ran a couple of studies where we looked at whether drivers of more expensive vehicles were more or less likely to, in one study, cut other cars off at a four-way intersection, or in a follow-up study, drive through a crosswalk without stopping for a pedestrian that we'd posed at that crosswalk waiting to cross. In California, that's really a ticketable offense. It's a violation of the law.
Yeah, in New York, it's mandatory. You have to drive through the crosswalk.
Perfect. That's what I've heard. And, yeah. And it's a reminder to really look both ways and then look both ways again before you even proceed to step off the sidewalk.
That's exactly right.
What we found here was that as the expensiveness of a vehicle increased, so the more expensive a person's vehicle was, the more likely they were to break the law by, for instance, driving through the crosswalk without stopping. And it was statistically significant. But not only that, the effects were really, really profound. In our low status category, none of the cars failed to stop. So all of our low status cars stopped for the pedestrian, let the pedestrian walk through. But that high status vehicle, that driver of the BMW or the Mercedes, they were just as likely to stop as they were to drive through. They were 50%. Their likelihood of driving through the crosswalk was 50%. So it was like a flip of the coin. So it was extremely significant, the differences that we saw between the high and low status categories.
I drive a 25-year-old Mustang with a bunch of rust spots in it, and I'm a very polite and cautious driver.
Well, then you'd fit right in. If only we'd had you included in our study.
Oh, yeah, the classic guy with a beater car that stops for everybody. Now, Paul, there's this in other experiments, you found a greater tendency to engage in a variety of other unethical behaviors, as you say. I want to ask you about a study you did with some colleagues from the University of Toronto, and one of the experiments yielded an almost onion-esque result that the wealthy were more likely than others to take candy from a baby. Tell us a little bit about that.
It sounds like it's, almost derivative from like a Simpsons episode really or something is. Like that.
Mr. Burns stealing Mr. Burns. Candy from a
okay,
baby.
So it sounds funnier than it actually is.
Yes.
So there's a measure that's been used in the past to look at how entitled the person is. And we adapted that for this study. So basically, we didn't just invent this out of the blue for the sake of making headlines. This is
right.
this is sort of a standard measure that social psychologists have used in the past. But it was fairly simple. We introduced participants to a jar of candy that we said was reserved for children participating in a study in a developmental lab nearby. And then we simply tracked how much candy participants took for themselves. So sort of indirectly, the more participants took for themselves, the less candy they understood would be available for these children participating
right.
in a lab nearby. And we found that in this case, we'd actually manipulated people's perceived levels of wealth. And people who felt wealthier took two times as much candy as participants who felt less well off. Again, pointing to this effect of feeling better off than someone else doesn't actually make you, we're finding, more compassionate, more empathic, and more likely to want to share resources with another person. It's the opposite. The more you feel you have, the more you want. And that's a really ironic effect. It's not as if you feel like you have more, your appetite for material resources is satisfied,
right.
and you're more likely to want to share resources with another person. It's almost like the more you have, the more appetitive or the greater your appetite looms, the greater it becomes and the more you're willing to do to satisfy that appetite.
That's a really fascinating finding. And you also found that they were more that the wealthy or those with higher socioeconomic status were more likely to cheat in a contest to win a prize. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, I love that study. We had people play this what we called a game of chance. They got on the computer and they're told, "Hey, it's your lucky day. You don't have to participate in all those boring psychological studies that you're used to. Today, you get to play a game." And in this game, the computer is going to virtually roll a die for you five times. And the higher your total is across these five rolls of the die, the better your chances are going to be to win this $50 cash prize. And because we can't track your roll, we need you to keep track of your total across all five rolls and report it at the end. But unbeknownst to participants, the game's actually rigged.
Right.
So they think the computer's rolling a die for them, but we've programmed the computer to roll the same score for everyone, totaling to 12. But by giving people the opportunity to report their score to us, we're giving them the opportunity to cheat. So any score that participants reported over 12, they're cheating.
Right.
Because it's impossible for them to have gotten that score over 12. And the higher your socioeconomic status was, the more likely you were to cheat. In fact, people at the top were cheating four times as much as people at the bottom, which is a really surprising effect. And that effect held when controlling for all sorts of other things like how religious people are, their political orientation, how old they were. So there really does seem to be the specific effect associated with your position in society and how likely you are to kind of privilege your own self-interests above the interests of other people. There's kind of this greed is good ideology, if you will, that's more favored the more high you are in the socioeconomic ladder.
Do you remember what the highest score was?
Lots of people reported 30. Reported the maximum. And how many of those people were people at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder? Zero.
Zero. I mean, it would be statistically so unlikely to roll five sixes. Finally, Paul, before I let you go, is there any way to make self-centered, wealthy people more empathetic to the suffering of others?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the really hopeful lessons that we've learned from the work that we've done. So beyond just documenting these differences, we're really interested as social psychologists in examining the kinds of things that can be done to kind of increase empathy or increase compassion or increase generosity among those who are more privileged in society. And that's an important point because we know that inequality is on the rise and wealth is increasingly concentrated in the hands of a select group of individuals. So how do you get people who have those resources to be more willing to take on responsibility for the plight of others? And we've run a lot of different studies looking at, for instance, simple interventions that induce egalitarian values, that induce compassion. In one, we had participants watch a brief video about childhood poverty, and then an hour later looked at their levels of volunteerism. And even that quick video, that 46-second video about childhood poverty that reminded the wealthy about the needs of others in other countries and in their own, an hour later made them be just as charitable and just as helping, just as compassionate as their less wealthy counterparts, suggesting that really simple things like reminders of the needs of others can go a long way toward fracturing the kind of insular world that wealth affords you with, and remind you of how important it is to try to help others when you can.
Paul Piff, I think we're about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
No, thank you, Josh. It's really been fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Folks, if you want to read Paul's most recent study, you can find it online. It's titled Wealth and the Inflated Self, and it was published in the Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. You can also read my take on it at BillMoyers.com, titled, Because I'm Not an Academic, A Plutocracy of Self-Centered Jerks. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with William Black.
Hear them say, dreadlocks can't live in a tenement. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Too much su-su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy. Too much su-su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement, yeah. Too much su-su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy. Too much su-su-su-su-su-su, too much watchy-watchy, yeah. Dreadlocks can't live in privacy. Anything him do, will nigger see. Too much watchy, watchy, watchy. Too much su 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 su. Too much watchy, watchy, watchy. Too much su 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 su. Dreadlocks can smoke and pipe in peace. Too much informers and too much beats. Too much watchy, watchy, watchy. Too much su 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 su. Too much watchy, watchy, watchy. Too much su 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 su. Dreadlocks can live in a tenement yard. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard. Can't penetrate in a tenement yard. Can't penetrate in a tenement yard. Skip, skip, oh, 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 oh. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard. Dreadlocks can't live in a tenement yard. Too much su 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 su. Too much watchy watchy wa. Too much su 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 su. Too much watchy watchy wa. Dreadlocks can't penetrate the rain man. All he might do is sell Jaja land. Too much watchy watchy watchy. Too much su 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 su. Can't penetrate in a tenement yard. Can't penetrate in a tenement yard. Dreadlocks can't lick him pipe in peace. Too much informers and too much beers. Too much watchy watchy watchy. Too much su 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 su. Too much watchy watchy watchy. Too much su 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 su. Can't hide the date in a tenement yard. Can't hide the date in a tenement yard.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm very happy to welcome William Black to the show. He is a former banking regulator and director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention, and he now teaches at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Bill Black, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to have you on to mark the fifth anniversary of the crash of Lehman Brothers, which was announced on September 15th, 2008, and it remains the biggest bankruptcy in American history. To date, a few loan officers, small fish, have been convicted of various offenses related to the financial crash. It also exposed some Ponzi schemes like Bernie Madoff's, but none of the big bankers have faced any charges. And it's not the that the government has been losing cases in the courts, there's simply been no concerted effort to prosecute these guys. Can you contrast that with what happened during the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s? And also, give us your sense of why this has been the case.
Sure. So the savings and loan debacle was 1/70th the size of the current crisis, both in terms of losses and in terms of the amount of fraud. In that crisis, the savings and loan regulators made over 30,000 criminal referrals, and this produced over 1,000 felony convictions in cases designated as major by the Department of Justice. But even that understates the degree of prioritization, because the regulators, worked very closely with the FBI and the Justice Department to create a list of the top 100. These are the 100 worst fraud schemes. They involved roughly 300 savings and loans and roughly 600 individuals. And virtually all of those people were prosecuted. We had a 90% conviction rate, which is the greatest success against elite white-collar crime in terms of prosecution in history. In the current crisis, that same agency, the Office of Thrift Supervision, which was supposed to regulate, among others, Countrywide, Washington Mutual, and IndyMac, who collectively made hundreds of thousands of fraudulent mortgage loans, made zero criminal referrals. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is supposed to regulate the largest national banks, made zero criminal referrals. The Federal Reserve appears to have made zero criminal referrals. It made three about discrimination.
Right.
And the FDIC was smart enough to refuse to answer the question.
Huh.
But nobody thinks they made any material number of criminal referrals. And what people don't understand about the criminal justice system is there are roughly 1 million people employed in it. Of course, millions incarcerated in it. But of the 1 million employees, 2,300 do elite white-collar investigations. And those 2,300, you have to contrast that to the number of industries in the United States, which is over 1,300.
Right.
Notice I didn't say corporations. I said industries.
Right.
So a couple of things should be obvious. First, the FBI agents will not have expertise in the industry. And second, they obviously can't patrol a beat. They have to wait till a criminal referral comes. And that criminal referral will not come from the bank itself.
Right.
Banks make criminal referrals against their CEOs. So it could episodically come from whistleblowers. But against an epidemic of this kind of fraud, that can never work. And it has to come overwhelmingly from the regulators. So when the regulators ceased making criminal referrals, which had nothing to do with an end of crime, obviously.
Right.
It just had to do with a refusal to be involved in the prosecutorial effort anymore. They doomed us to a disaster where we would not succeed. And it isn't just the criminal referral. Back in the savings and loan crisis, people like me, and I did this personally a great deal of my time, trained not only our regulators, but the FBI agents and assistant U.S. attorneys how to identify fraud schemes, how to respond to fraud schemes, to document the crimes. And then we detailed our top examiners on the most complex frauds so that they worked for the FBI as their internal experts.
Right.
On the investigations. And then people like me testified as expert witnesses for the government. And again, we had prioritized these things, so we were going against the absolute worst of the worst and most senior of the people. None of those things have happened now. And because of changes in modern executive compensation, it's very uncommon for people to blow the whistle.
Right.
In the modern era. It isn't so much that you lose your own bonus. Think of yourself, what people often don't understand is that executive compensation bonuses go down very low in the food chain. And so if I'm a boss and I see, a crime being committed, if I blow the whistle, it isn't just that I will lose my bonus. It's that Fred and Mary, who report to me, with Fred with three kids about to go to college and Mary with a kid that has severe problems, who's trying desperately to save up to get a wheelchair-accessible van, I know that they'll lose their bonuses as well. And so it's not even my greed, of course. It's my altruism that gets in the way. And, whistleblowers often blow the whistle because of altruism. But here they see how many of the own people that report to them and they're responsible for would be hurt. So we haven't had much in the way of whistleblowing to begin with. And then the administration, you will notice, has never, and this means both the Bush and the Obama administrations, never made a call for the good people to come forward, the ones who fought against the frauds and were disciplined and such because they did so. And the Frontline special investigated this found that as soon as the word got out, they were deluged with people giving them information. And the common characteristic when they talked to them is that the FBI had never even talked to them. And, of course, lately, the Obama administration has been having an unholy war against whistleblowers. So when you wiped out criminal referrals by the agencies and you virtually wiped out criminal referrals by whistleblowers, you made it impossible to get the information you needed so that you could identify the fraud schemes at the major players, get the key witnesses, and bring the cases.
It almost sounds like if I could offer an analogy, if you were trying to prosecute homicides and you had no police on the streets, no homicide detectives, and no snitches, your hands would be tied, even if you were a tenacious prosecutor with some ambition, huh?
It's actually far worse than that, because as a prosecutor of those kind of cases, I end up with a corpse that has a small entry wound and a large exit wound.
Right.
And I know there's been a homicide.
Right.
And I can use forensic evidence to go after those people, even in the absence of witnesses. No such things occur in the elite white-collar sphere. Instead, what occurs is I told you about the death of criminal referrals by the agencies and the virtual death of criminal referrals by whistleblowers. But what you did still have was the lenders themselves making criminal referrals against the hairdressers of the world.
Right.
Right. So, and they made collectively hundreds of thousands of such criminal referrals. So at peak in the savings loan crisis, again, 1/70th the size of this crisis, of those 2,300 total FBI agents, 1,000 of them were working on just one industry, the savings and loan industry, to produce that incredible wave of success that we had. As recently as fiscal year 2007, there were only 120 FBI agents nationwide assigned to mortgage fraud. And that's even though the FBI itself, in September 2004, warned the nation that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, epidemic was their word, and predicted that it would cause a financial crisis. Crisis was their word, unless it were stopped. So what happens instead? You get these tens of thousands per year of criminal referrals about Fred and Mary, the little folks. And so every single one of those 120 FBI agents was doing Fred and Mary cases.
Unbelievable.
And they were not in a national task force. They were divided up in what the military would call penny packets, two in this office, three in this office, that type of thing. And so there was no conceivable way that they would find fraud at the large institutions because they never looked. And then comes, and actually in the same year, in 2007, the FBI forms what it calls a partnership with the Mortgage Bankers Association. Well, the Mortgage Bankers Association, of course, is the trade association of the PERPs. Right. The Mortgage Bankers Association set out, imagine the audacity, to con the FBI, and they succeeded. They ginned up this fake definition of mortgage fraud under which the lending institution was always the victim and never a perpetrator, including the senior officers of it was never a perpetrator. And the FBI bought this hook, line, sinker, and the boat they rowed out to go with all of this. And so we have the incredible anomaly of the first African-American president of the United States of America with an African-American attorney general, Mr. Holder, and they have adopted at the FBI level the Tea Party definition of the crisis, which is that the banks were pure, and this is the first virgin crisis conceived without sin in the C-suites, and instead it's those nasty, ultra-sophisticated hairdressers who con the poor, unsophisticated bankers from Harvard and Columbia and NYU.
Right, right.
Caused this crisis.
Conservatives are convinced that the Community Reinvestment Act played a major role, despite a dozen studies showing it did not. And it's like a zombie myth. You can stab it and you can shoot it, and it just keeps walking.
Well, that's why there is this perfect natural experiment, as we refer to in social science. We can't ethically, experiment in these ways. So we look for things that simply happen and test. And the great way to figure out why things were being done is to look at liar's loans. And so these are the loans where you don't verify the borrower's income.
Right.
And the industry's own experts said that these loans were 90% fraudulent, right? So study after study after study has shown that it was the lenders who put the lies in liar's loans, the lenders and their agents, right? And nobody ever made a bank make a liar's loan. It has nothing to do with Community Reinvestment Act, indeed, because the purpose of it is to inflate the borrower's income. It takes you out of community reinvestment, and no entity, and this includes Fannie and Freddie, was ever required to purchase a liar's loan. In fact, they didn't qualify as credit for affordable housing goals because you didn't verify the borrower's income. So by after all these warnings from the industry, industry's own fraud, anti-fraud experts about them being 90% fraudulent, and the fact that even the Bush administration anti-regulators said, don't do these things. The industry between 2003 and 2006 increased its liar's loans by over 500%.
Wow.
By 2006, 40% of all the loans, home loans made that year were liar's loans. And half of all the loans called subprime were also liar's loans. These are not mutually exclusive categories. Remember, there's a 90% fraud incidence in all of this. That means there were over 2 million fraudulent loans made in 2006 alone. Now, that's one way of looking at it, but even more stark is in 2000, the year 2000, we are talking about over 13 years ago.
Right.
The association, the group of associations of honest appraisers, created a petition and circulated it widely throughout Washington, D.C. and through the industry. So they go all to the regulators and the prosecutors and the industry, and the petition is eventually signed by over 11,000 appraisers. Now, note the date again, 2000. This is over a year before Enron hits. In other words, we got a warning about this crisis, the third crisis, savings and loan, then Enron era, then this crisis, the mortgage fraud crisis. But we actually got the warning about this crisis before Enron failed, before the second series of crises that we usually think. And the appraisers, it's really simple. Here's what they say. There is an epidemic of lenders who are extorting us as appraisers to inflate the appraisal. And when we refuse to do so, they blacklist honest appraisers and refuse to use them in the future. Okay, so what can we figure out from that, right? Number one, it's coming from the lenders.
Right.
Number two, no honest lender would ever inflate an appraisal.
Right.
Because the appraisal is your great protection against loss. So three, the lenders are inflating an appraisal for a reason, to cover up losses on the underlying mortgage fraud that they're also engaged in. Number four, these loans are being sold in the secondary market. So we know that the fraud is propagating through the system. And you can't sell. The only way you can sell to the secondary market is by making what we call reps and warranties, representations and warranties.
Right.
And of course, you can't make a rep and warranty that says, hi, I'm selling you a fraudulent product.
Right.
So you can only sell a fraudulent loan through fraud. And there's no fraud exorcist. So the fraud has to go through the system. And it has to come out the other end when they sell the CDOs, the collateralized debt obligations, and the mortgage-backed securities. So you have the entire crisis analytically easy to figure out in 2000. And we had a law, the Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act of 1994. And as that name implies, we had it throughout the crisis. And it allowed the Federal Reserve, and only the Federal Reserve, to stop liar's loans at any time. And first Alan Greenspan and then Ben Bernanke refused to use this authority. Bernanke finally, under congressional pressure, used this authority on July 14th, 2008, to kill liar's loans. But even then, he delayed the effective date of the rule by 15 months because you wouldn't want to inconvenience a fraudulent lender.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Let me ask you this. Up until the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, the size of the financial services industry grew and shrank along with the larger economy. It moved more or less with the business cycle. It wasn't perfect. But when the economy was booming, finance grew as businesses needed more loans and people wanted to buy big-ticket items. And then when we were in a recession, it tended to shrink. That never happened after the dot-com bubble burst. Finance was about 8% of our economy, and it stayed that way until today. It had little ups and downs, but the trend line has been pretty consistent. Bill, finance made up less than 3% of our economy in 1950. What does this say about where we are today economically? What does this tell you?
Well, it tells us that the tail wags the dog. Mm-hmm. And that it wags the dog into recurrent crises, right? So it's like a disease tail. A tail is, of course, designed for balance, and it's supposed to help things right themselves. This tail, throws folks into the ditch. In addition to the numbers you gave, the percentage of all corporate profits that go to finance is now back up to, after the crisis, to the peak it was before the crisis, which is roughly 40%.
Wow.
So, that is staggering.
40% of all corporate profits. So we're not building things. I mean, this is an intermediary good like trucking.
Yes, it's a middleman.
It's a middleman good.
And the economics for a middleman are very clear. It should be small, and you should be trying to minimize it.
Right.
And it should have very low returns overall in your economy. So finance is strike one, strike two, strike three in the traditional things, and it's all about power.
Right.
And it is not just economic power, it's political power. This is the modern phase of crony capitalism. And so it is the great threat, not just to our economy, but also to our democracy. And that's particularly true in a Citizens United world,
right,
in which these banks can use their political power to drive what we've seen.
Right.
I mean, I could have never imagined that in my lifetime an administration would actually say that there were entities too big to prosecute.
Right. Too big to jail.
Too big to jail. I actually developed that phrase before this as a way of trying to embarrass the administration. I've given up. They're past they are beyond the ability to embarrass. They right. adopted the phrases.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my. Bill, let me ask you this, and I guess I'm shifting gears here just a little bit. What does the term moral hazard mean? And how do you think the fact that we didn't prosecute any bankers and that we bailed out the industry affected Wall Street's behavior going forward?
So moral hazard is a concept developed originally in insurance and was quickly applied to banking as well. And it says when there's a real asymmetry between risk and reward, you can produce either or both fraud or wildly imprudent risks.
Right.
And that either of these things in the banking context can lead to disastrous financial consequences. Now, even though we have known for centuries that this produces what we in criminology now call control fraud, which is when the people who control a seemingly legitimate entity use it as a weapon to defraud, and that this happens in banking and is a leading cause of the most catastrophic bank failures and bank crises, neoclassical economists, suddenly when they get to moral hazard, only talk about risk.
Right.
Right? They ignore the fraud component.
They also only talk about it for the little people.
Right. The hairdressers.
Right. The hairdressers. They're the ones
theory,
we have to worry about.
Right. That has now been adopted by the FBI and the economic profession. And again, this myth of this is the first virgin crisis.
Right.
In which the elites are the victims.
Right.
Right. And the FBI and the Justice Department are the brave, virtuous people who are protecting the poor, innocent bankers from the bloodlust. I am quoting, by the way, the Washington Post. The bloodlust of the public to go after these poor, innocent bankers. And fortunately, we live in a country like America where the lawyers for the Justice Department are unwilling to be so unjust as to follow the crass prejudices of the public. It's an extraordinary tale. And again, for the Obama administrations of all administrations to adopt this theory and say that it's the poor black, moms and pops who caused this crisis is surreal. What the failure to prosecute under any theory of economics and any theory of criminology means that the next crisis is far more likely and that it's going to be far larger because you just said you have a sure thing. Remember, this accounting control fraud recipe is a sure thing that guarantees that you will be made wealthy immediately
right.
as the controlling officers. And now there will be no risk, zero. There is not a single elite banker who caused this crisis in prison, period. So you have absolutely maximized what we call a criminogenic environment, and a key element of that, as you say, is that we have taken moral hazard, the fraud dimension, and pushed it off the scale in maximizing it.
My final question is this, is about just very briefly about the regulatory response we did get following the crash. Dodd-Frank has been hailed as a significant new reform by some. It has been panned as a watered down nothing burger by others. Does the truth lie somewhere in between? And how much risk remains in this system?
Right now, less risk is apparent because the economy is so crippled.
Okay.
Once we get back to a boom, the bad stuff will reemerge. So the good news, bad news about the weak recovery.
Right.
And it's slowing down the next crisis by continuing the current crisis. Dodd-Frank doesn't address any of the three central elements that create the criminogenic environment that produce the recurrent intensifying epidemics of control fraud that drive our ever-worsening crises. Those three elements are, first, the creation of these systemically dangerous institutions, the so-called too big to fail. And the administration won't even be honest about them. It calls them systemically important, like they deserve the gold star.
Right.
But their definition is when, not if, when the next one fails, it will, like Lehman, cause a global financial crisis. These institutions are too big to manage effectively, so there's a complete win-win-win-win. Were we to force the shrinkage of the systemically dangerous institutions down to the point where they no longer endanger the global economy, we would, one, reduce global systemic risk. Two, we would make markets far more effective. Even conservatives say that when there's a systemically dangerous institution, that free markets are a myth.
Right.
And their metaphor is it's like bringing a gun to a knife fight when they compete against anyone else. So we would have better markets. We wouldn't have the global systemic risk. We'd have more efficient banks because these are too big to manage, and we would remove one of the leading threats to our democracy of crony capitalism. So that's the first thing, and Dodd-Frank doesn't deal effectively at all with the systemically dangerous institutions. Its idea is to keep them around, which is nuts. Second big thing is modern executive and professional compensation, which creates the perverse incentive structures and is the means of looting that the CEOs use. And that has gotten worse since the crisis, and there is nothing effective in Dodd-Frank dealing with either executive or professional compensation. Remember, I talked about how they use compensation to try to coerce appraisers
right,
to commit fraud. So the third area is what we call the three Ds. These are deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization. Well, we've already talked about decriminalization, so that's gotten to as bad as it can get. None, right? No prosecution.
Right.
Deregulation, that's slightly been reversed. We have banned liar's loans. We have created a new consumer bureau that, time will tell whether it can be effective. But most of Dodd-Frank, that's it in terms of regulation. There's stuff on the Volcker Rule, and we still don't know whether it's going to get out of the industry's embrace, but we certainly know they'll be able to evade it under Dodd-Frank. So deregulation, a little plus, but nothing to brag about. Desupervision, still disastrous. So we still have the holders of the world refusing to prosecute. We still, in most of the agencies, have anti-regulators. And we have, as we speak, the idea that you're going to take Larry Summers, the most prominent anti-supervisor of them all, the architect of financial crisis after financial crisis.
It's so crazy.
And that you want to promote him for his failures. So people can go back to the first time I was on Bill Moyers, and I said, what you must understand is that these people are being promoted and put in positions of power because they have a record of failure, because they are willing to do whatever needs to be done for the largest banks. So desupervision, boy, we've got that in spades. And this is the ultimate testament to crony capitalism, the idea that you would reward Larry Summers for causing crisis after crisis by giving him the capstone of his life by making him the Federal Reserve chairman. It is beyond insanity.
William Black. I believe we are out of time, unfortunately. A very depressing conversation, but I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you very much.
I also want to thank Paul Piff. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can read my stuff at BillMoyers.com. And you can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. All one word, that's a new email address for the show. Of course, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. Have a great week.
So tired, I don't know what to do.